Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to this, the 10th, or probably more the 11th or 12th, of the lectures organized by the Cold War Studies Center on the theme of America as another country. And we've explored many, many aspects, many problems, both past and present. And today I think we're going to again try to bring the present cast in the shadow of the past. And there's nothing probably more important in the past of the United States, which still cast a long shadow and even it's got its own term, a syndrome, as Vietnam. And I'm delighted this evening to invite a friend and a colleague from the Department of History at New York University, Professor Marilyn Young. Marilyn's reputation, both in the United States and around the world, for her work on empire, on Vietnam, on many, many aspects of American foreign policy is formidable. I've got her long CV here. I won't read it all out. Marilyn would be far too embarrassed if I were to do so. But I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight to this lecture, Marilyn, to talk on the topic behind you, which you can see very well established here, Vietnam and the American Dream, from Saigon to Baghdad. Marilyn, you're most welcome here this evening. Thank you very much. Yeah, you've got to talk into that mic. Hit that mic.
Yeah, I will. But I probably can't be seen over the podium by... Well, I'm here anyhow. I've seen the title of my talk and also that Emily is missing, which I took to be a true and sad case of a missing 15-year-old until I read it more closely and it turned out to be a movie. Before I begin my talk, let me pass on to you a reassuring observation given Robert Kaplan, an American journalist with close ties to the Department of Defense, by a senior Pentagon official. Quote, "After Iraq, we hope not to be invading a big country for a long time. So we'll be reduced to low-profile raiding, which the military has a very long and venerable tradition of from the 19th and early 20th century," end quote. On the other hand, large countries shouldn't relax too much. Last June, Kaplan announced the arrival of a, quote, second Cold War. Some would argue it's really the third, alternately that we're still on the first. And this time, the main enemy is China. In a lengthy essay in the Atlantic Monthly entitled, quote, "How We Would Fight China," Kaplan wrote that China is, quote, "the principal conventional threat to America's liberal imperium. The Pacific," he predicts, "will be the scene of the defining military conflict of the 21st century, if not a big war with China, then a series of Cold War-style standoffs that stretch out over years and decades," end quote. Kaplan welcomes the prospect, and so probably do many in the Pentagon. China is an enemy suited to the capabilities of the American military establishment. Big guns all around. I can no longer remember the origin of the title of my talk for this evening. It could as well have been called The American Nightmare from Seoul to Infinity, or less apocalyptically, U.S. Foreign Policy 1945 to 2006 and beyond. The title I choose now would probably be Che Guevara's Curse, Two, Three, Many Vietnams. I mean this in three senses. First, that Vietnam looms over every major U.S. foreign policy decision. Second, that all efforts to avoid another Vietnam have led inexorably to the reproduction of many of its central tropes. And finally, that the American use of its power has produced multiple forms of ongoing resistance. Every U.S. military intervention since 1975, with the possible exception of Grenada, has been marked by a "don't look now" quality. Vietnam was written, albeit in invisible ink, all over what I suppose some now think of as the good Gulf War, or the better Gulf War, the one in 1991. The form the message took then was of what must not be done. The press must not be allowed free access to soldiers or battlefields. Bodies must not be counted. Intervention must not be gradual, but rather massive. The military should not have its hand or its hands tied behind its back. American casualties must not be allowed to rise, and the war must not drag on. All these conditions having been met, the first President Bush was able to boast at the war's remarkably speedy conclusion that the Vietnam Syndrome had at last been kicked. By the Vietnam Syndrome, Bush meant the reluctance of the American policy to allow the government to engage in military adventures in faraway places whose relation to the national interest was obscure to the general public. Urged to go for broke and take Baghdad, the first President Bush refused. As he later explained in his memoir, quote, trying to eliminate Saddam would have incurred incalculable human and political costs. We would have been forced to occupy Baghdad and, in effect, rule Iraq. There was no visible exit strategy we could see, violating another of our principles. Furthermore, we had been self-consciously trying to set a pattern for handling aggression in the post-Cold War world. Going in and occupying Iraq, thus unilaterally exceeding the United Nations mandate, would have destroyed the precedent of international response to aggression that we hoped to establish. Had we gone the invasion route, the United States could conceivably still be an occupying power in a bitterly hostile world, end quote. That was the first President Bush. Despite Bush's, oh, and by the way, about exit strategy, there was a very big anti-war march in New York last week, underreported everywhere, especially in New York. And there were two very fine signs. One that I like very much said, the rapture is not an exit strategy. And the other one said, I love my country, but we really should be seeing other people. The quote from Bush about the exit strategy reminded me. Despite Bush's hopes, the Vietnam Syndrome proved to be more like an allergy than a disease from which the country could be decisively cured. In the presence of similar irritants, it was likely to flare up again. Combat in Gulf War I had lasted little over a month, yet Americans seemed no readier to send U.S. troops abroad after it was over than they had been before. Frustration with the public aversion to war was bipartisan, angering Democrats quite as much as Republicans. What is the use of the most powerful military force in the world, Madeleine Albright complained to Colin Powell, if you can't use it? On the whole, the Clinton administration found it best to exercise that force from on high. And for a while, it seemed that high-altitude bombing against undefended or lightly defended targets was the permanent shape of U.S. military endeavors abroad. U.S. military endeavors would now take. In these circumstances, the Vietnam analogy did not come into immediate play. I mean, Clinton could have bombed Kosovo forever without anybody talking about Vietnam as an analogy, as something to be aware of, although it might have recalled the bombing practices of that war. On the other hand, with some notable exceptions, the Christmas bombing of 1972, for example, America's air wars are usually only semi-visible, sometimes entirely invisible to anyone but those in the path of the bombs. That was the case in Korea, and it has been the case in the current war in Iraq as well. The attack on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, made it considerably easier for Americans to bite the bullet, so to speak, and fully embrace war as an instrument of foreign policy. The Bush administration declared that the attack was an act of war against the United States by al-Qaeda and those states which harbored its operatives. In retaliation, the country went to war against Afghanistan, starting with an extended bombing campaign, followed by special operations forces whose mission, still unfulfilled, was, in the words of President Bush II, to bring back Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Along the way, the fanatic Taliban would be deposed in favor of a peaceful, stable, representative government freely chosen by the Afghan people. American support, public support, for the war in Afghanistan was near universal, although at least one old Vietnam hand, R.W. Appel, saw its ghost as early as October 2001 in an article entitled, quote, A Military Quagmire Remembered, Afghanistan as Vietnam. By November 2001, the U.S., in concert with its allies, had defeated the Taliban, and enough of a government had been put in place in Kabul to allow Bush to declare victory. Thereafter, with the exception of sporadic attention to failed efforts to capture al-Qaeda's ever-elusive leadership, which usually resulted only in the killing of Afghan civilians, or the cover-up of the death by friendly fire of an American sports icon like Pat Tillman, or the threat of death to a Christian convert, with these exceptions, Afghanistan has simply disappeared from the newspapers, the TV, and apparently the consciousness of the American public. This indeed may be the fulfillment of the Bush administration's American dream: to invade a country, establish a dependent government, secure a permanent military base, and achieve all this out of sight and mind of the voting public. For current information on Afghanistan, one must go to non-American news sources or the State Department Travel Advisory website, where one is informed, quote, "Travel in all areas of Afghanistan, including the capital, is unsafe due to military operations, landmines, banditry, armed rivalry among political and tribal groups, and the possibility of terrorist attacks, including attacks using vehicular or other improvised explosive devices, IEDs, and kidnapping. The security environment remains volatile and unpredictable," end quote. This sounds a lot like Iraq, and yet Vietnam has not yet begun to haunt the effort in Afghanistan, perhaps because the U.S. troop commitment and the number of casualties remain low. In terms of domestic politics, often the crucial factor in U.S. foreign policy, Afghanistan carries few dangers. This may change. I mean, I should say that this is, I think the situation in Afghanistan is changing, but at the moment, what I've just said remains the case. The main casualties thus far have been civilian farmers shot down by U.S. helicopter gunships. All of which brings me to the current war in Iraq. What was clear to some people at the time, what by now has been repeatedly documented, is that the Bush administration, with the knowing compliance of its only serious ally, Great Britain, was intent on war in Iraq, irrespective of any possible threat Saddam Hussein could have posed to the United States. To avoid any hint of the eternal return of the Vietnam War, with its confusion as to why the U.S. was there at all, the Bush administration invoked its considerable experience in press manipulation, half-truths, and outright lies, and applied it to the task of scaring Congress and the public into believing, or at least not being certain they could entirely dismiss, that Saddam Hussein possessed an armory of weapons of mass destruction, the term itself intended to conjure fear, all aimed at the United States, and not only weapons, but direct connections to the very terrorists responsible for the unprovoked attack on Washington and New York in September 2001. This time, the public would know why its army was been sent abroad to fight. This time, American troops really would be, as many of them assured the press, fighting over there so they wouldn't have to fight over here. And troops going to Iraq on their helmets had Fire Department New York, FDNY, in honor of the firemen who lost their lives in 9/11, or they had on their helmets Avenge 9/11. And the conviction that Saddam Hussein was directly responsible for the attack, a conviction propagated by the Bush administration, is what allowed, I think, for a certain ease in the early days of the war. So in March 2003, the administration had its way. The war began on March 19th with, as you may remember, the intense bombing of Baghdad intended, as the main proponent of shock and awe described it, to, quote, take the city down. By April 9th, 2003, the city was down. During the Vietnam War, only one reporter, Harrison Salisbury, wrote about the destruction caused by the U.S. bombing of Hanoi, and he did it only once in 1966. The bombing of South Vietnam went largely unreported, even when targets were located conveniently close to Saigon. This time, reports of the destruction wrought by shock and awe were more readily available, though often the reporting stressed the precision with which the weapons were dropped. Thus, the reading and viewing public could see the enormous crater dug into a densely populated neighborhood in Baghdad by four 2,000-pound bombs, where Saddam and his sons were not. Though with few exceptions, most reports failed to discuss who was there. Anthony Shadid, one of the very few American reporters who speaks Arabic, later wrote that as the war went on, quote, it was more difficult to comprehend the violence that continued to take innocent lives. Standards for targets fell, he wrote, and the end was, quote, bloodier, and the edges of Baghdad often felt like a free fire zone, end quote. Within weeks of the toppling of Saddam's statue, the vocabulary of the Vietnam War was back in use with only minor modifications. Credibility gap, search and destroy, the difficulty of telling friend from foe, military resentment at civilian interference, the Sunni triangle, used in Vietnam, it was the Iron Triangle, that area near Saigon, including the city of Cu Chi and the tunnels, where resistance continued uninterrupted for the whole time of the war. In Iraq, it is called still now, I'm not sure it's still the Sunni Triangle, but early in the war it was called the Sunni Triangle. Indian country, as a way of naming Iraqi cities, towns, and neighborhoods outside of U.S. bases, winning and losing hearts and minds. The most recent and visually stunning Vietnam recall was the military's provincial stability assessment published in the New York Times early in April of this year. There was a color-coded map of the provinces which were labeled in terms of stability: critical, serious, moderate, or stable. And this precisely mirrors the Hamlet evaluation system used in Vietnam that anybody who's following Vietnam War at the time would be familiar with. In late March 2003, Orville Schell raised the possibility of a developing quagmire in Iraq. So that's the same month as the war begins. And a Guardian headline at around the same time read, "Marines losing the battle for hearts and minds." When the reporter, James Meek, asked a Marine if there had been enemy forces in the village his unit has just destroyed, he replied, "It sort of depends how you define enemy." A line just short of Vietnam-era identification processes: if he's dead, he's VC. Once over the shock of meeting opposition, in Iraq as in Vietnam, soldiers on the ground, as well as senior commanders, describe the enemy as fanatical and unfair. Their soldiers hide amongst the civilian population, forcing the U.S. to kill civilians. They wear ordinary clothes. They are brutal to prisoners of war. In both conflicts, the tactics of the enemy were said to reveal their indifference to the value of human life, which then became the grounds for U.S. indifference to their lives. In all three as well, according to memoirs written by veterans, a growing dislike for the entire population of the country in which, and presumably for whom, they fought sometimes overwhelmed them. A Marine corporal told a British reporter amidst the wreckage of some 15 civilian cars and the bodies of 12 civilians, including a small child, "The Iraqis are a sick people, and we are chemotherapy. I am starting to hate this country," he added a little incoherently. "Wait till I get hold of a frigging Iraqi. No, I won't get hold of one. I'll just kill them." End quote. By the fall of 2003, the notion of an Iraqi quagmire had become commonplace. Max Boot, an enthusiastic historian of small wars, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times called "Lessons of a Quagmire." If the U.S. was not to repeat the errors it had made in Vietnam, Boot wrote, it must relearn the lessons of counterinsurgency, recreating the successes of the Vietnam era, where the CIA, quote, oversaw aid programs designed to win hearts and minds of South Vietnamese villagers, end quote. That they had not, in fact, won the hearts and minds of South Vietnamese villagers did not give Boot pause. Excessive brutality, Boot warned, can be counterproductive in fighting an insurgency. But there is also a danger of playing by Marquis of Queensberry rules against ruthless opponents. Our military may simply be too Boy Scoutish for the rougher side of a dirty war. More should be done to recruit relatives of those killed by the Ba'athists, who would be eager to pursue a blood feud against Saddam Hussein's men. Arguably, though not quite in Boot's terms, that is precisely what is happening in Iraq today. This is actually a frequent refrain, that American troops are sort of just not brutal enough to accomplish the necessary tasks of empire. It requires really not looking at what's happening on the ground and having instead a preconceived notion of how it is that the American army fights. For American troops, Iraq, despite the absence of jungles, merges with Vietnam War movies on which they grew up. John Burns has reported the, quote, snatches of dialogue from Apocalypse Now that soldiers on patrol exchange, and the, quote, black joke from one Marine about the landscape resembling a Vietnam theme park. And that's a sentence that one can really contemplate for a while, that Iraq, the place they're in, is not Vietnam, which they know nothing about except from the movies, but a Vietnam theme park. For their officers, it was an opportunity to put into practice what they believed they had learned from U.S. failures in Vietnam, how to get counterinsurgency right. And this is a theme I'll come back to a couple of times in my talk. Yet in the event, in this effort to get counterinsurgency right, they sometimes reverted to what one might call the dark side of the famous Hearts and Minds slogan, quote, grab their balls and their hearts and minds will follow, end quote. Major John Nagle, for example, a longtime student of the Vietnam War and author of Counterinsurgency Lessons from Vietnam and Malaya, lost interest in Iraqi hearts during his first tour of duty in early January 2004. I'm not really all that concerned about their hearts right now, he told a reporter. We're into the behavior modification phase. I want their minds right now. Maybe we'll get their hearts later. Over time, I'll start winning some hearts. Right now, I just want them to stop shooting at us, stop planting IEDs. If they're not involved in these activities, they should start turning in the people who are, end quote. In the summer of 2005, Max Hastings, the British military historian, recognized that his earlier dismissal of Vietnam analogies as premature and melodramatic were wrong. Quote, Vietnam comparisons have become unavoidable, he wrote. As in Vietnam, the hope of constructing a viable local government capable of ruling a united country was unlikely to happen in any conceivable period of time. As in Vietnam, U.S. intelligence was fatally weak, and there was no sign progress had been made on the hearts and minds front. The experience of ordinary Iraqis with the United States, Hastings wrote, is at best alienating, at worst terrifying. American forces bring nothing in their wake that Iraqis can perceive as good or helpful, only a cacophony of military noise, spasmodic death, and destruction, end quote. There was one significant difference, far lower U.S. casualties. Nevertheless, and there always is a nevertheless, Hastings, like so many pundits in the early 1970s with respect to Vietnam, warned against precipitous withdrawal. Such action, he cautioned, would produce anarchy. In due course, some old, half-forgotten players joined the fray. The November-December 2005 issue of Foreign Affairs featured Melvin Laird, Nixon's Secretary of Defense. And most of the people I know, when they saw this, said, was he still alive? And it was kind of astonishment that Laird was not only alive, but had written this big article. It's a long essay on the lessons of Vietnam, in which he discovered that 30 years ago he'd been entirely correct. Vietnamization was a success. The U.S. had won the war during the Nixon presidency, and then Congress, quote, snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, end quote, by refusing to fund the South Vietnamese so they could carry on the fight. And Laird's lessons for the present, quote, in Vietnam, the voices of the cut-and-run crowd ultimately prevailed, and our allies were betrayed after all our work to set them on their feet. If we fail now, a new standard will have been set. The lessons of Vietnam will be forgotten, and our next global mission will be saddled with the fear of its becoming another Iraq, end quote. Early on in the war, it was the opponents of the war in Iraq who most frequently drew on comparisons with Vietnam. More recently, as Laird's essay illustrates, the comparison has been used by those who support the war but want the U.S. to fight it differently. In particular, analysts are once again mourning the inability of the U.S. to master counterinsurgency warfare. In the September-October 2005 issue of Foreign Affairs, Andrew Kupinovich, who had written a critical account of the Vietnam War, the Army and Vietnam, published an essay entitled How to Win in Iraq. At the same time, General John Abizaid, among others, was reported to be reading A Better War, Louis Sorley's 1999 account of how the United States had essentially won the war and then abandoned its allies and so on, the Laird line. It's worth looking more closely at these new uses of an old lost war. Kupinovich insisted that withdrawal from Iraq would mean, as the Nixon administration claimed it would mean in Vietnam, until in 1973 they did it, a bloodbath, a signal of America's weakness. Instead of withdrawing, what the United States needed was, quote, a real strategy built around the principles of counterinsurgency warfare, end quote. Rather than hunt and kill insurgents all over the place, the military should concentrate on establishing security and providing services in certain key areas, and then slowly over time expanding those areas of control. During the Vietnam War, General James Gavin had proposed a similar approach in Vietnam and called it oil spots. And with a kind of poetic aptness, Kupinovich calls it the oil spot strategy now as well. The problem with the oil spot strategy then, as was pointed out at the time, is that you really couldn't expand it. I mean, you could barely even secure Saigon, much less expand it anywhere else. So the notion that this will be possible in Iraq has some of, indeed, almost all of the same flaws as it had in Vietnam. What Krupinevich does is to raise, and this happened over and over again in the Vietnam War as well, the example of Malaya. The British did it in Malaya. We must look, the United States must look, to the British colonial experience for inspiration and for guidance. He did not address the terms of British victory, the herding of virtually the entire Chinese population of the country, almost 500,000 people, into a set of closely guarded villages, the creation of a police state, the post-war violence, the ongoing repression. But let's suppose Krupinevich is right, and some territory can be secured and even expanded. The future he promised, I mean, if all of this goes well, the future he promised in his Foreign Affairs article is a little bit on the grim side. His strategy, he warned, requires a decade of total commitment on the part of the American people, the expenditure of hundreds of billions of dollars, and more casualties. This is the price, Krupinevich wrote, of America's, quote, worthy goals in Iraq. Krupinevich puts it to the people, as Max Boot did 3 years ago. Are the American people and American soldiers willing to pay that price? The only way to find out, Krupinevich wrote, would be for the Bush administration to present the people, quote, with a clear strategy for victory and a full understanding of the sacrifices required, end quote. And if Americans are not up to it, well then the government must settle for a more modest goal. Outmaneuvering Iran and Syria, this is a quote from Krupinevich, and creating an ally out of Iraq's next despot, end quote. Krupinevich never explains how the American people, much less American troops, are to make their wishes known. Through opinion polls, desertion rates, the polls are down. Recruitment rates, despite lavish bonuses, remain low. Desertion rates are up. In the face of this, Krupinevich, like Max Boot and a host of others, has only one weapon, the bully's taunt. Are you man enough to fight through to victory? Have you the will? We are back inside Apocalypse Now, channeling Joseph Campbell with Marlon Brando, or maybe just upriver with Conrad in Heart of Darkness. Krupinevich's resurrection of counterinsurgency doctrine has caught on. On the third anniversary of the war this past March, the Wall Street Journal ran a story with the headline, "As Iraq War Rages, Army Reexamines Lessons of Vietnam." According to Reporter, quote, "The emerging consensus in the Army is that in order to move forward in Iraq, it must better understand the mistakes of Vietnam." So we're right back to R.W. Apple and the first days of the war in Afghanistan. This story gets recycled on an annual basis, and it will continue to be recycled for as long as the war in Iraq goes on, or the next one. The major emphasis of the new counterinsurgency doctrine is on the need to, quote, curb the military's use of firepower and focus instead on building a government in Iraq that is seen as legitimate in the eyes of the locals, end quote. American confidence that it can create a legitimate government in other people's countries is based in part on the deep conviction that it is itself always and everywhere at home. The only foreign fighters in Iraq, in the U.S. press and in government reports, are Arab extremists. This happens over and over again. You see a report and it says foreign fighters were killed, foreign fighters arrested by U.S. Marines who have suddenly been made into what? The indigenous population of Iraq. Krupinevich and Laird are in general agreement. Iraqification and or spreading oil spots plus good marketing of a clear mission are all it takes to win in Iraq. On November 30th, 2005, George W. Bush combined these elements, added a dash of Lewis Sorley's book on never abandoning an ally, and declared that from now on, the American army would clear and hold and build in the towns of Iraq. As Lawrence Kaplan observed in the New Republic, this was good news. U.S. forces will no longer be fighting World War II all over again in Iraq, but it's also bad news, he wrote. Tactical and operational concepts that were tested and found wanting in Vietnam would be revived. At this point, I want to focus on a town called Tal Afar. I don't know if it's been as much in the press here as it has been in the United States, but it's sort of the intersection of Iraqification, which means the training of the Iraqi army and police forces by the United States, Iraqification exactly on the model of Vietnamization, turning it over to them to fight, and also the new counterinsurgency, or a resurgence of the old counterinsurgency doctrine. Tal Afar is a city of 250,000 people, largely Turkmen Shia, 150 miles west, northwest of Baghdad. At the end of November, Bush pointed to Tal Afar with pride. In contrast to the poor showing of Iraqi forces in the battle for Fallujah in 2004, the assault on Tal Afar was led by Iraqi forces, Bush said, which conducted their own anti-terrorist operations and controlled their own battle space. Bush loves using terms like that, straight out of the video games, battle space, hunting for enemy fighters and securing neighborhoods block by block. At last, Bush wrote, these units have helped to maintain law and order, reconstruction projects have been started, and Tal Afar has been provided with jobs and hope. Tal Afar could have done with some hope. American troops had conducted repeated massive assaults against the city in the past, including air assaults. The officer in charge of the most recent offensive was Colonel H.R. McMaster, like Krepinevich, a student of the Vietnam War and the author of Dereliction of Duty, a book about the Vietnam War, whose subtitle is worth reading, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Lies That Led to Vietnam. So that's the book McMaster wrote in 1997, and now in 2005, he's leading the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Tal Afar. And he has become a kind of, at least in the United States, a TV icon. He was on 60 Minutes, which is the Sunday News Magazine program on TV. He had there's a big story on him in two New Yorkers ago by George Packard. He was the subject of front page of a New York Times Sunday Magazine article. McMaster is very, very serious about counterinsurgency. While troops were still in the United States, he set up a 3-week course in Arabic for the officers. There was a reading list of books on Iraqi history and a reading of classic texts in counterinsurgency. Once in Iraq, according to several articles by admiring journalists, he moved swiftly to curb the indiscriminate use of firepower and the abusive treatment of prisoners. As one of his officers put it, quote, you can come in, cordon off a city, and level it, a la Fallujah, or you can come in, get to know the city, the culture, establish relationships with the people, and then you can go in and eliminate individuals instead of whole city blocks, end quote. Clear, hold, build, and kill selectively is now the preferred approach to pacification in Iraq, preferably in the company of the American-trained Iraqi military. By February of this year, McMaster was confident he had created, at the very least, a fragile stability in Tal Afar. And Bush, echoing this at a big speech at the City Club of Cleveland, Ohio, talked about how peace had returned to Tal Afar, how children could go to school, how prosperity was on its way. The American press never questioned any aspect of this account of what was going on in Tal Afar. They only wondered, very, very mildly and politely, whether what had been achieved in Tal Afar could be replicated elsewhere, in Baghdad, for example, which is 30 times the size of Tal Afar. But few questioned that peace had returned. Current accounts of the situation indicate renewed insurgent attacks. People are afraid to send their kids to school. And a small group of journalists was escorted around the city in early April, accompanied by, quote, two squads of heavily armed troops who kept watch front, rear, and flanks, rifles at the ready, and wouldn't let the group linger for more than a few minutes in any one place. Overhead, a helicopter gunship shadowed the group, which was in any case confined largely to Shia neighborhoods. A Sunni resident of the town said that 0% of Bush's talk about Tal Afar is true, and Shia residents weren't much happier. The conclusion of one, the smell of death here is everywhere. People never know why they are killed. They only know that the Americans are the cause of their agonies, end quote. Vietnam and Iraq have come together most sharply in two recent events, the revelation that the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Jordanian and forgive me because I won't pronounce this correctly, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, rather than the mastermind behind the majority of exceptionally vicious suicide bombings of civilians, is to some extent literally an American creation. I don't mean that he doesn't exist, but the sense of what he does, who he is, his control of things, is created by American military intelligence. And the second thing I want to talk about is what has been called the Rebellion of the Generals. Let me talk about both fast so that there'll be time for questions. An investigative reporter for the Washington Post learned of a campaign by U.S. psychological operations officers in Iraq to, quote, magnify the role of al-Zarqawi and his organization in the ongoing insurgency, or as the military, in a mix of comic book and business school language, put it, quote, villainize Zarqawi / leverage xenophobic response, end quote. For 2 years, military intelligence has planted stories in the Iraqi press and on TV, and in the American press as well, by the way, stressing the role of Zarqawi, playing, as the report puts it, on Iraqis, quote, perceived dislike of foreigners, end quote. The focus on Zarqawi has many virtues for the administration, perhaps particularly in terms of the explicitly targeted domestic audience. On a pattern made familiar by Vietnam, the stress on al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is Zarqawi's organization, obscures the extent of Iraqi support for the insurgency, puts the United States unambiguously on the side of the Iraqi people, and revives the flagging connection between 9/11 and the war in Iraq. The military believes the campaign, still ongoing, to be the most successful information campaign to date, quote, and this is maybe my favorite quote from the whole thing, through aggressive strategic communications, Zarqawi now represents terrorism in Iraq, / foreign fighters in Iraq, / suffering of Iraqi people, / denial of Iraqi aspirations. What we're finding, Major General Rick Lynch explained, is indeed the people of al-Anbar, Fallujah, and Ramadi specifically have decided to turn against terrorists and foreign fighters, end quote. Maybe. But meanwhile, the police in Fallujah are on strike in protest against the alleged abuses of Shiite army troops put in place in that Sunni city by the U.S. The second event recalls Vietnam in the negative. After the Vietnam War, senior military officers were accused of having kept silent despite their knowledge of how disastrous the entire enterprise had become. McMaster's 1997 book, Dereliction of Duty, focused on the acquiescence of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in civilian war plans with which they profoundly disagreed. And the book has become required reading in the military. Since the current global war on terror, or as we call it in America, the GWAT, looks like it will never end, senior officers who have recently served in Iraq are speaking out now, accusing Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld of gross mismanagement and once again destroying the army. The sound of small animals scurrying to abandon the sinking ship of the Bush administration amplifies daily. So does this mean Iraq is Vietnam? It was not Vietnam in 1991, and it is not now. The political, social, cultural, economic history of Iraq and the organization and tactics of the Iraqi insurgency are radically different from Vietnam. Vietnam haunts the Iraq war only in part because it has begun to smell like defeat. Far more important is that the task the United States has taken upon itself is similar: to bend to its will a country about which it knows little, whose language and history are unknown to its soldiers. The link to Vietnam is a haunting, not a serious engagement with the history of the Vietnam War, nor the direct application of lessons learned there, no matter how earnestly the masters of counterinsurgency claim they can do it better this time. Meanwhile, as in Vietnam, but even less visibly, the air war in Iraq has intensified over time. And there's a lot of speculation, particularly by Seymour Hersh in a recent article, that when the U.S. troops withdraw, the air war will not end, but rather will be taken over by Iraqi military forces. I can talk more about the air war later if you like, but I want to, oh, just one quote. 500,000 tons were dropped on Fallujah by one Marine air unit alone during the fighting for the city in 2004. there were no estimates of civilian casualties. An official told Seymour Hersh, quote, there was no sense of an air campaign or a strategic vision. We are just whacking targets. It's a reversion to the Stone Age, end quote. A final thought. In relation to Iraq, as to Vietnam, many people are convinced that only victory gives meaning to the lives lost, that is, to the American lives lost. To stop fighting short of victory is to render meaningless the deaths and maiming suffered thus far. More deaths, more grievous wounds are required to one end only, giving meaning to the deaths and woundings already suffered. Are you going to tell that mother whose son is in a casket that you don't believe in what they're doing over there? An irate mother asked a reporter. Do you know how that would hurt them? We don't have that right. A Doonesbury cartoon, and Doonesbury, you know Doonesbury, right? Because it appears in The Guardian. Maybe you all saw this one. It's the best recent Doonesbury, I think. Doonesbury cartoon of a presidential press conference lays out the grotesque logic of this, which is very common in the United States, perhaps here as well. Mr. President, asked the reporter, you've been arguing that we must remain in Iraq to ensure that those who've given their lives didn't die in vain. What if our troops are still dying at the current rate a year from now? Will we withdraw then? No, the president answers, because if we do, all of next year's deaths will have been in vain. What about 2 years from now, the reporter insists, or five? And Bush answers, again, we'll stay the course. We cannot dishonor the upcoming sacrifice of those who have yet to die. Remember, some of them haven't even enlisted yet. If we cut and run, what kind of message would that be sending them and their families? That they might live, the reporter says. Dishonoring their own future deaths? I don't think so. George Swires, returning directly from the battlefield of Vietnam to San Francisco in 1970, remembered how he had, quote, set out to speak to his fellow Americans, to share with them his hideous secrets, to tell them what went on daily in their names, end quote. For a short time, the message that Swires and other veterans like him brought home to America, also known as the Vietnam Syndrome, served as a prophylactic against another Vietnam. In the decades that have passed, the hideous secrets have been forgotten, or worse, transformed into memories of virtue, sacrifice, and service. The mythology of redemptive sacrifice is a commonplace of the representation of war from Troy to Stalingrad. But the myth grows especially perverse in relation to wars of aggression, whose promulgators present war itself as the highest expression of the national will. The popular rejection of this perversity, the idea that U.S. aggression implements the nation's moral superiority, the rejection of that idea was the key symptom in the Vietnam Syndrome. Its reappearance, that is, the reappearance of the syndrome, as expressed in Bush's rapidly falling polls, is responsible for the administration's intermittent efforts to find a way out of Iraq. The danger is that the way out they prefer may be through Iran. Thank you. Yeah, I'll sit down. So those of you who couldn't see me, this is incredible.
This is the speaker. Okay, I'm sure from that presentation there's going to be an interesting set of questions. So can
that podium
we,
was made for Arnie. It's not
yeah,
made
it's
for
made for big guy. Yeah, okay. Can we take the first contribution from the floor? Yes, sir. Please. There's a microphone to your left if you want to use it. Form of a question, please. Thanks.
You referred to the Vietnam War. I read that a week or so ago, Bill Gates, the head of Microsoft, has made a trip to Vietnam and has received a very rapturous reception there. So one wonders whether the shooting is dying down, what that war is about. I mean, it seems that American businessmen are going in there doing deals with the present government just as if before it was communist. So I'm just asking what you comment on that. I mean, the government seems to have certain values, and maybe the Americans in a few years were doing big business as they were before. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Vietnam since 1986 has been changing in exactly this direction. And one could argue that it really has had to, that there was very little space for it to do anything else. Noam Chomsky has argued that this demonstrates that, in fact, the United States won the Vietnam War General William Westmoreland used to say the same thing. I don't think that's true, in fact. I think Vietnam's victory over the United States, not to put too fine a point on it, was of immense importance, both for the Vietnamese people and for the shape of their independence and their Now, the course they are currently choosing economically, resembling that of China, very closely that of China, isn't really so much of a surprise, given the necessities of their geographic and political location. So yeah, Gates is received rapturously, and hopefully he'll have a good labor policy, and that's not such a terrible thing, and the fight against globalization has to be taken on more broadly than by a single country like Vietnam.
Okay, right. There's a lady in red there, please. And then we go across. We'll take a couple. Thanks.
Hi. When you compare the two external enemies in Vietnam and Iraq, i.e. In Vietnam it would have been communism and the domino theory, and in Iraq it's Islamic fundamentalism and Al-Qaeda, do you think it makes it easier for the American public to stomach the Iraq war because there was actually an attack that happened on American soil as opposed to during Vietnam when the enemy wasn't so present?
Well, actually, the American people stomached the Vietnam War for a very long time, and it's remarkable what a people can stomach. I mean, you know, not just Americans, but one can think of other countries in which much is stomached as well. But yes, in answer specifically to your question, the so-called global war on terrorism, fought rather fitfully by the administration of the United States at the present moment, what did ease the feeling of the public about the war in Iraq, based on what I said, and I really mean, the direct lies of the administration about that connection. So people really believed it. I mean, an astonishing number of people believed it, and continue to believe it, and will believe it till the day they die, that Saddam Hussein ordered those planes to attack the World Trade. Sure, it eases it. And terrorism is the new, and anti-terrorism is the new anti-communism. That is, it functions in the same way in terms of American needs and interests of its of this administration.
Okay. Mary.
I heard a speech by Senator John McCain over the weekend where he mentioned that he thought the war on terror would continue for the rest of the century. So I was wondering if a similar comment was ever made about Vietnam and what you think about that comment.
No, no such comment was ever made about Vietnam, and I think it's a kind of silly thing for him to say. I mean, terrorism is a tactic. Asymmetric warfare will no doubt go on for the rest of humanity's future history, which I won't be around to see, but you may, some better portion of it. And sure, there'll be asymmetric warfare. Terrorism will remain a tactic of weaker states and weaker movements, sure. And there'll be struggles against it. But terrorism isn't an ideology. I don't know. I don't think for anybody is terrorism itself the point. Terrorism is about achieving other sorts of goals. It is not my preferred political tactic, but I don't think a war on terrorism is, it doesn't make sense. It's a propaganda title. In fact, you know, at one point they tried to change it to call it the global struggle.
The long war, I think. The what?
You know, that's the global war on terror, but then there was a move to call it the global struggle against extremists, or something like that. It didn't catch on. I don't know why.
Great. Yeah. William Wallace.
Can I attempt you to take the comparison into the American academic community? I happened to be at Cornell during the early stages of the Vietnam War, and our Southeast Asia Center was much criticized and its funds cut by the government because they kept saying uncomfortable things about the history of Indochina and so on and so forth. I was conscious that I was in the middle of a behavioral revolution in which American political scientists were retreating into quantitative work away from policy work. But as the war eventually went on, some political scientists object to this, and you will recall the APSA very nearly split. Here we are again. There's been pretty vicious attacks on academics who have questioned what has been constructed as the global war on terror, and indeed have questioned the American understanding of the Middle East. An orthodoxy has been imposed. Political science has retreated to rational choice. away from policy, and I haven't yet seen the revolt coming the other way unless John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt survive the latest attack.
Well,
tell me where you see how you see the academic policy and political science community under the stresses which it has been in the last 2 to 3 years.
God, that's a depressing question. It truly is. There is a fair amount of writing against the current policy. There really is. At the same time, it's by people who have been writing against U.S. policy from 1973 on. And in other words, they haven't changed. There's nothing new. And they are regularly ignored, as they were ignored for all of the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. The American, the court historian of the moment is John Lewis Gaddis. He is an historian. He's written a book called A New History of the Cold War, which is essentially his old history of the Cold War, recycled yet again. And he is the standard, he's the received text now. He gets his picture taken with Bush, and he is considered everywhere the top of the American academic establishment with respect to foreign policy. Political science at my university is entirely rational, that's NYU, is almost entirely a rational choice. It's boring, it's useless, it's wrong. All of that makes absolutely no difference. It's very, very safe. The Middle East Center at my university is a dissident one. Michael Gilsonen, who's actually from here, leads it in its dissidence. I mean, maybe it's because he's a Brit that he's able to do so. It has absolutely no influence whatsoever. And what happened to Mearsheimer and Walt is a warning of the limits of what you can say. It is extraordinary. And the person who's most strongly defended them has been Tony Judd, who's, again, not an American. I think we're at Cornell in the earlier period, I'm afraid.
I'd have to say that not all the Brits who went to the United States were like that. Bernard Lewis, I think, actually
talk about him.
went to Princeton and provided the kind of historical justification for the war. Yeah, lady at the back, please.
The Vietnam Vets campaign against John Kerry during the elections, and so that part of the Vietnam syndrome where it seems to me that the attention to injustices or atrocities committed by Americans and criticism of that doesn't seem to really form part of the larger American consciousness, because, you know, I think the majority opinion in the U.S. at that point was against Kerry on that, on his criticism, against his criticisms.
Well, you know, it's really hard to know. First of all, that was a small group of veterans. They were very, very, they were very tied into the Republican Party. And they're a small hatchet group. They don't represent, I don't think, the majority of American veterans. But Kerry himself, you see, tried to do both things. He tried to say, I was in the war, not like Bush, who was in the National Guard and he even cheated there. I was actually in the war, I did my service, and I was against the war. But he tried to do both things at the same time in a way which left an opening for the kind of attack that he got. Had he done what he's done most recently, was to give, on the anniversary of his own testimony before Congress in 1973, which was the best speech he ever, he hasn't made as good a speech since, he gave a speech saying, essentially, I was right then. Nowhere in his campaign did he say, boy, I was a smart young kid. That was really true what I said. He didn't do that. Instead, he mealy-mouthed all over the place and, you know, tried to explain away a vote he should never have taken for a war in Iraq. He tried to explain it away, but he did take it. And he couldn't explain it away. So, I don't know. Now, it's connected to the other question. I mean, Kerry's speech in 73 wasn't about it was about the war as such. It wasn't about specific atrocities. The American reaction to Abu Ghraib, like the reaction to My Lai, although they're very, very different events, one is the massacre of the village, the other is mistreatment of prisoners of war, which also went on in Vietnam and which nobody ever responded to in any way. But there was an immediate reaction of revulsion and of worry. This is taken care of by both the media and the government by instantly naming, you know, the people who did it directly, not and sealing off the higher command from any prosecution or having to answer questions directly. They're protected. So there's a prison guard from upstate New York, a truly unattractive guy, and this young woman that was in his sexual thrall. And they're the ones who get charged. And nobody wants to associate with them. They're just bad apples in the good American barrel of apples. And that way of dealing with it, which happened to a certain extent with Kelly as well, Lieutenant Kelly and Milan, is a way of, first is the reaction of, oh my God, can our good sons and daughters do these terrible things? I guess they can, but only a few of them, and they're really unattractive, and those are not our children, and we reject them. And that's the way that it's dealt with. I don't know that, what's the response here? There's this court-martial now of four British soldiers for drowning a 15-year-old Iraqi.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
And I have no sense of a public reaction here. No. I don't know if there is or not.
I don't think so. Can I take up two of the issues you raised about towards the end of your talk on the obvious differences between Vietnam and Iraq? And they're pretty self-evident, I know. But just to pick up two of the obvious ones which you sort of touched on but didn't develop because of time. One, does it make a big difference that the army in Vietnam was obviously a conscript army? And the scale of the killings and the scale of American deaths was much higher. I mean, so far it is 2,400 American lives and others ruined. You know, by this, you know, by the equivalent time into Vietnam, you're up to about the 25,000 mark. So the scale of it and the fact it was a conscript army, it does seem to me makes a big difference to its impact back in the States. I think the other obvious difference is that you, in the end, you could see an exit strategy out of Vietnam. You know, you could see the way out, because in the end, what Kissinger and Nixon did, and you've written about this with great skill and clarity over many years, but it's an old story. Nixon and Kissinger made a deal with the Soviet Union, made a deal with the Chinese, with Mao, to, in a sense, get them off the hook out of Vietnam, and so they could actually have an honorable peace, which they finally concluded in Paris in 72 around that famous table. And that then gave them a breathing space, a decent interval between the peace which was signed as a result largely of Russian and Chinese pressure on the Vietnamese, which was regarded at the time by its betrayal. I just don't know. I mean, looking at it brutally, you know, from a strategic point of view as is perceived by the United States, I don't know what the exit strategy looks like. You know, in terms of getting your peace with honor, getting out so it doesn't leave the place worse than it already is, with a major base for international terrorism. So could you take up a couple of those points, Marilyn, and see where you want to run with that before we bring in other voices? Yeah.
Well, to talk about the first, the fact that there's no conscription has meant that anti-war sentiment is harder to mobilize. Yeah. It's somewhat less visible. It expresses itself more like the Korean War. It expresses itself in polls. So, you know, Bush's polls go down, down, down. The most incredible, I mean, really astonishing. Which is the way it happened in Korea, that the Truman's polls went way down. Disapproval of the war went way up in Korea, but there was no mass movement on the streets. And although there are large anti-war demonstrations, they're nowhere near the strength and the political strength that they had during the Vietnam War. And conscription has made that difference. On the other hand, what's happening to the military now is extraordinary, and it is responsible directly for this protest by the generals. After the Vietnam War, there was this effortful rebuilding of the military, of its sense of honor, of its training, dealing with drug problems, all of that. And the volunteer army, smaller, shapelier, was the way to do it, and it was apparently successful. For those who follow these matters say, really, the military had restored itself. Then comes this war, and the same thing is happening. The constant redeployment of troops has led to people signing, you know, filling out their time and then getting out, who would have otherwise been perhaps their whole careers in the professional military. Young officers are refusing. They're fulfilling exactly their contract and then getting out and going into other businesses. Business is the right word too. For the Army, it's been devastating. Mm. And I think the current unrest in the military at the senior officer levels is a serious problem for those administrations who wish to use force in a kind of easy, relaxed way. You can't do it when you've got a military in semi-rebellion at its senior ranks. I may be exaggerating that some, but it has been a pleasure to read these generals protesting against the war.
Plus Secretary of State Colin Powell's the Chief of Staff as well.
Right.
What about the second thing on the exit strategy then?
On the exit strategy, in Vietnam, the line was, first of all, there is no honorable end to a dishonorable war. There just isn't. There wasn't in Vietnam, and there isn't to this one. And there's nothing that can make it honorable. And Vietnam was worse off than before we went in. Of course it was. And in answer to the earlier, that's part of the answer to the earlier question about the path Vietnam has taken, in terms of just the sheer destruction of the place and the shredding of its social fabric and all of that. So the argument here is there'll be anarchy if U.S. troops pull out. Well, so far as I can tell, there's large, and it depends how you define anarchy, but there's chaos and bloodshed everywhere now. The United States, there was this wonderful, on a TV talk show, and some American politician says, well, we've just got to go in and tell them to just, you know, get their government together and do it. Well, what is he talking about? I mean, how can anybody do that? He really believes it, that all it takes is for the American government to go in and say, you know, pull up your socks and cut out this militia shit. Stuff.
You heard it first at the LSE.
So,
yeah.
So will it be worse if the United States pulls out? I don't know. It's pretty bad now. Mm. It's very hard for me to know. I really don't know. The people I know who know Iraq well say it's as bad now as it can get, and that it won't get worse with the United States pulling out, and it might get better. So I don't know the answer to that.
No.
I know it's an excuse to stay, that sentence.
Okay. I think there was another hand up over here somewhere. Yeah, the lady here. Yeah, please, we need the mic. We'll take two or three more, and then we'll draw it to conclusion. Yeah, please.
You said that in previous wars, the U.S. was...
Yeah, speak up a bit, I think, yeah. Thanks.
You said in previous wars, the U.S. was very keen to conduct its activities out of the public eye and out of sight of the media where possible. And I was wondering what you think about the proliferation now of embedded journalists in Iraq and what difference that has made, and whether that was a result of the US and the British military maybe being overconfident at the start about what those journalists would be seeing, or whether it was sort of bowing to the inevitable pressure of the 24-hour news media and more technological capabilities that they have, and whether you think now that... ironically, really, that what gave us the pictures of what it's really like on the ground there is now making us immune to the images of, you know, children with their heads being blown out and you know, women and children lying dead in the street. What do you think about that phenomenon?
Well, you may see those images here. In the United States, they're very, very rare, almost not at all. And that's true, by the way, of the bombing of Baghdad to begin with, and of Gulf War I. European and friends told me that they had seen things on in Gulf War I that I had never seen, and on TV at all, of the nature of the killing there. But as far as embedded journalists go, it's sort of, you know, Gulf War I, they had the press pool and total control of access. In this one, they decided to loosen a different tactic to do this embedding thing. The embedding thing is really very smart, because what it does over and over again is it connects, and reasonably, the journalist to the troops who are protecting him, after all. So the journalist is riding along with a unit that is getting shot at, but the journalist is also getting shot at, and he doesn't want to die, and he doesn't want the... And then there is all that, you know, bonding that is said to occur in military units, I don't know, and that kind of intense comradeship. And the reporter, who is not in the military, sort of gets off on that as well. And in the beginning of this Gulf War, there were a number of journalists who said, I was against the war, but then here I am with these young men, and they are and women, and they are protecting me, and they really are, you know, they're so young and they're so American, and I like them. What it did was to modify the edge of the reporting, not always, but often. There's a guy named John Sassaman. Sassaman was recently forced to resign his commission. He was an officer. And Dexter Filkins, New York Times reporter, who, by the way, had been sold the story about Zarqawi by the PSYOPs people in the military. Filkins does this big story about Sassaman. Sassaman is this hero officer. I mean, he is so upright. And he has given Filkins so many good stories. And then Filkins learns that Sassaman has been charged with lying about the fact that troops under his command forced two Iraqis to jump into the Tigris and one died. And Filkins's attitude towards Sassaman and towards this event isn't as forthright as you might think it could be, in part because Sassaman, he's been traveling with Sassaman. He knows what, you know, the tough conditions under which Sassaman lives and how terrible these convoys are that go out into Iraqi neighborhoods and get shot at or blown up, worse, by improvised explosive devices. The language is also interesting, by the way. IEDs, improvised explosive devices. If you said it's a homemade weapon, you say it's a homemade weapon, it gives you a sense of the nature of the opposition. If you call it an IED, it gives a very different sense. I mean, it's like it's being shipped in over the borders to be planted, that kind of thing. The language of in which you transform this insurgency into something else is also interesting. But yeah, I think embedded reporters have softened the edge of news. Fox, most Americans, or I don't know how many, because I never want to know, it's true, watch Fox TV as their main source of news. Fox TV is a straight-up propaganda channel. There is no news on Fox TV. Seriously, I'm not exaggerating. There truly isn't. It's just not what Fox TV does. It's a propaganda arm of the Bush administration. That's how it functions. And indeed, the new press secretary comes from Fox TV. No accident. So, that's where most Americans get their news. And then the rest watch Jon Stewart late at night to get, you know, a different sort of news. It's very distressing.
Mm. Take one final question, one at the back, and then we'll finish for this evening. Yeah, lady at the front, and then gentleman at the back, please. Somewhere else? Oh, there's one at the top there. I'll take one at the top as well. So take three. Yeah, please.
Okay. I just wanted to follow up on your very last comment about the way out being through Iran. I mean, how could they possibly imagine that in terms of your comparison between Vietnam and Baghdad being unwinnable, think that suddenly Iran will give them a winnable?
Well, there, you know, it won't be another Iraq, because if they do anything in Iran, it will be from the air. I don't think it would be ground troops. I don't know. I mean, it sounds quite mad that they would try that there would be a military confrontation in Iran. It sounds completely nuts, especially, just to take one time, in the New York Times, on the same page, Bush administration warns Iran, oh, you better not do this nuclear thing. In a small article inside the paper, Bush administration officials traveled to Tehran to discuss Iraq. The contradiction is mind-boggling, and it's there. Tehran, Iran, helps the United States to manage the occupation in Iraq. That's what it does. Now, if there's any restraint on Bush using military force against Iran, it's that necessary help that Iran proffers to the Bush administration in Iraq in terms of controlling a Shia militia. So I don't think they will, but the answer, the short answer is they'll bomb, and therefore it won't be like Iraq. It will be like Kosovo.
There's a chap at the back there, and then we'll take one final one there, okay? Yeah, please, yeah, at the top.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to get some of your knowledge and what you know about something which is certainly a very hot topic at the university which I attend, but which I can't find much information from, which isn't in sort of niche media sources, and that's the issue of depleted uranium. I mean, is it the Agent Orange of Gulf War I and Gulf War II?
The short answer is absolutely it is. Sure it is. And there is, I mean, in the American press, there's zero. You may get it in niche media here, but the insofar as it filters in, it's online and it's from non-U.S. sources about the use of depleted uranium. There are some people who refer to it as the notion that there hasn't been any nuclear weapons used since Hiroshima is belied, these reporters say, by the use of depleted uranium, which was used in Kosovo, and it was used in Gulf War I, and it's been used in this Gulf War. The numbers of Iraq Gulf War I veterans complaining of symptoms is enormous, and the government has dismissed two suits, but one suit, there have been damages paid, but the damages have been not for anything as specific as DU, but rather for something called Gulf War syndrome. And that refers to, could be psychological, it's a kind of settling out of court to just get it out of the limited public eye it ever had. But DU is an ongoing problem, and it's not just American troops, of course, it's a problem for the countries in which it's used, and an ongoing problem. And I don't know any organization around that subject at all.
And the last question from the gentleman in the back, please.
Yes, I'm interested in your assessment of the lack of student concern about the Iraq War. I'm sure you are aware of Berkeley, Madison, Columbia in America in the 60s and early 70s. And are students asleep on this issue? Or is it the conscription issue? Is it about the fact that they don't have to go? But and where's the faculty on these issues? I mean,
that was the question earlier.
Right. Where are you guys? What's going on?
Okay. Well, I talk all the time. Who listens? You know. Yeah. I mean, I do my. Yeah, you're listening, and my students listen, and the others like me who talk listen as well. Here's the really peculiar thing about the United States: Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky get audiences of thousands, literally thousands, and they get audience of thousands in states like Florida. I mean, not known for its political activism. I mean, a university town like Gainesville, which was asleep during the Vietnam War, 2,000 people came to hear Howard Zinn denounce American foreign policy. There are a couple of answers to your question. One is the lack of conscription, and that's very real. I denied it in my book. You will see in my book, it is not the case that the anti-war movement depended on conscription. It went on past 73 and blah, blah. But I have to admit, seeing now, there is a real difference. The lack of that threat of conscription really has made a difference, not just to students, but to their families, who are much, much more relaxed about this one because their kids are not going to have to go. That's and the people who do go have no political power and no political weight. It's even more true the National Guard, in which, I mean, you know, those families just don't have any, have no weight politically whatsoever. So conscription is part of it. I don't think the faculty is asleep. There's a different, I don't know how to think about this, and this is so off the top of my head that you must forget it as soon as I say it, and don't tell anybody I said it, but a lot of people I know, including myself, spend an enormous amount of time online, and we learn immense amounts, much more than at a comparable time one knew about Vietnam. I mean, just incredible resources for knowing things. So you stand up after several hours of reading, and you feel you've put in a full political day's work. And a lot of people feel that way. They're completely engaged, and it's virtual. Now, when Move On, an organization that was formed at the time of the Democratic primaries, used the net to organize people for Howard Dean, you had a sense of how the two could come together, how online mobilization could have an effect that you could see, this amazing from the bottom upsurge of a little known conservative Democratic governor from this one of the smallest American states and the whitest American state, Vermont. Dean was eviscerated by other Democrats, just eviscerated by the leadership in the Democratic Party, just torn apart. And Move On, that organization, just sort of the air just kind of went out of it. The other part of the answer to all of the questions about opposition is that at the time of the Vietnam War, with all of his many, many faults, you had Bobby Kennedy, and then you had McGovern. They didn't win, but they were places to organize around and to have an effect upon both them and then a kind of public face and TV time and all the rest of it. Now you've got a Democratic Party. Well, there is there's no opposition. The Democratic Party is not an opposition party. There is no opposition. And the result of that is a kind of, well, what do you do? The notion of voting for Hillary Clinton, you know, one is just disenfranchised. Yes, of course. I'm sorry. Of course. Yeah. Anyhow, but there must be a more upbeat thing where we can reflect on Bolivia, on.
I was thinking of bringing my Jimi Hendrix CDs along to play for everybody to cheer you up, the Star Spangled Banner to end the meeting this evening. I wonder also if there may not be also a third reason for what you call student passivity, although it didn't seem too passive here on February 2003 when 1.5 million people marched through the streets.
No, nor was it in the United States in February 2003. The question is what's happened. Yeah. Now there's the war.
I think in this country students are so much in debt. You know, they're having to work their pants off trying to simply repay these ridiculous loans that they have to take out because we no longer have a free education system. But I mustn't say that in this university, where students, of course, pay huge fees. Anyway, I have said it, and please now forget it under Chatham House rules. Marilyn, firstly, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, an extraordinary
thoughtful and provocative, I think, but quietly provocative reflection on these parallels. We try and make these kind of silly parallels and analogies, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But I think what you've done tonight is also show again the creative use of history. You know, how history lives and how certain analogies are drawn. I thought one of the most interesting things you said, you know, was everything still seems to be done through that shadow of a rewritten Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. You know, and I actually bring this also back to the whole question of what happened to the United States in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan. You know, this was when the Vietnam War was rewritten, refought, and won in the mind of Ronald Reagan. And I think this also is still playing a huge role today with this particular administration. Now, you've ended on a kind of down note, but let's
Bolivia. I said Bolivia.
Oh, Bolivia. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, we'll end on Bolivia. I'm afraid the Cold War Studies Center doesn't have a lecture on Bolivia up its sleeve at the moment, but no doubt we can imagine one very, very quickly. But anyway, no further ado. Thank you very much for coming along tonight, asking some great questions, and thanks to our speaker for a terrific performance. Thanks very much.